Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is James Wolfen of Metro Blooms. And he's here to talk with us about his research on pollinator communities and lawns and a program that Minnesota has put in place to help address the issues related with this. So, James, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
So let's start with this. I want to talk a little bit about your research because I think it kind of lays the groundwork for why these programs are important or why these programs to put in place turf alternatives really matter. So tell us about the research that you recently completed.
Yeah, so my research or the research project as a whole goes back to the University of Minnesota, where my two research advisors, Drs. Marla Spivak and Dr. Eric Watkins, they wanted to take an alternative approach to how we manage lawns. So traditionally, lawns are managed for aesthetics, where you just want this manicured green surface. And what they viewed is that in many cities, many urban and suburban areas, the lawn is kind of the largest green space. And they want to see how we can alternatively manage these areas to support the diversity and provide forage for our pollinators. So this started with a different graduate student. His name is Ian Lane, and he asked a very simple question. What low-growing flowers can we grow in a lawn setting to promote bee diversity? Kind of what flowers can grow alongside the turf? So he isolated the flowers that were best suited for a lawn setting, and then I came in and I looked at two different settings. So one, the value of naturally occurring lawn flowers to bees, and two, what happens if we artificially or intentionally introduce flowers to a lawn to support bee diversity.
So, James, can I jump in and ask, what are the those flowers that were being specifically looked at that were isolated when we say naturally occurring lawn flowers?
Yeah, so we were looking at one flower specifically. That was Dutch white clover. And the reason that we use that flower is because it is just so common in our yards, and there's this misconception that this flower is a weed, or at least, in my opinion, a misconception that this flower is a weed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go across any lawn in Minnesota, I know in my home state of New York it's commonly occurring, you'll see Dutch white clover in almost every lawn. The only exception to that would be if there's a homeowner or some land manager that's actively treating against it. And we really want to show land managers, we want to show homeowners, just the community on the whole, that if you instead view this flower as a source of forage and really look at the incredible diversity of bees that use this flower as a source of forage, we can kind of alter perceptions. It can really change how people view this flower. And what we found for Dutch white clover alone was pretty incredible, at least in my opinion, where we saw over 50 species of bees that use Dutch white clover as a source of forage. And that number of 50-plus species is almost 20% of the total bees that are present in the state of Minnesota.
Wow. So Dutch white clover, I want to focus on that for a bit. And obviously the question is that something that might grow in this environment? We certainly grow our share of bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass. So we can grow grass here. Can we grow Dutch white clover or a clover that's similar to it? Any sense of that?
Oh, I would bet that Dutch white clover is in your lawns and you just don't realize it already. It's that little white flower only 2, 3, or 4 inches off the ground.
Mm.
And if you, you know, take time to look a little closer at it, you'll probably see bees all over it.
Okay.
All right.
So then this is going to get mowed periodically. So clover can withstand, you know, typical maintenance of lawn like that?
Yeah. So turf plots I used were mowed once every 10 to 14 days. They were mowed just by the local park service. And every time I came back to my research site, the flowers grow back fast enough where as long as it wasn't, you know, 1 or 2 days after a mowing event, there was already blooms.
Right.
So the flower blooms as low as 1.5 or 2 inches off the ground, which is lower than even most mowers are set to.
Hmm.
So as long as you're not doing, you know, a mow of 1 or lower inches off the ground, you should have clover blooms at pretty much all times.
Okay.
So then you also looked at lawns that were seeded with wildflower, right?
Yeah, and we kind of wanted to bring two different populations into the fold. So when I was looking specifically at Dutch white clover, it was kind of for that homeowner who doesn't really have an emotional or a personal investment in it. It's just, if you do nothing and just let the flowers go, what happens? With those floral enhancements where we were intentionally seeding flowers into the lawn, then we were kind of targeting those communities that want to make an active, that are really striving to improve their ecological environments, that want to make an active effort and a little bit of a, put some funds towards supporting those bees, supporting wildlife on the whole, and saying, if you purchase some seed to just sprinkle over your lawn, so you just apply it as an overseeding, then what happens to your bee diversity? Hmm. You see more bees than just if you had just what Dutch white clover alone, or are the bee communities mostly the same? And we did see that if you intentionally introduced new flowers to the lawn, there were more bees, there were different species that we weren't seeing before, and just a healthier bee community on the whole.
Again, these are flowers, other plants that can be periodically mowed and will return.
Yeah, so that was actually, so floral selection, which was done by a previous student whose name is Ian Lane, that was probably one of the most difficult parts of this project on the whole, was determining what flowers are appropriate for a lawn setting. So we wanted all flowers that bloomed at 2.5 inches or lower.
Okay.
Got it.
So then it becomes compatible with the lawnmower.
So, exactly. If we were trying to use flowers that bloomed at 8 inches, 12 inches, 18 inches off the ground,
right,
then it's no longer that traditional lawn aesthetic that we're associated with. Then you have more of a native prairie in your yard. So we wanted to allow people to have that traditional lawn recreation, that traditional lawn activity that they're used to, even a little bit of that traditional lawn aesthetic, but just also incorporate some flowering plants that your bees will thank you for including.
So then some surprising things happen when you release this research, right? This kind of led to a statewide initiative.
Yeah. So in Minnesota, we're lucky enough to have what's called this Pollinator Task Force, who was appointed by former Governor Dayton, where he set up some of the great researchers in our state. So my advisor, or I guess now my former advisor, Dr. Marla, that being one of them, they were set to kind of put together some sort of policies that they thought would improve the state of bees or the state of pollinators in the state of Minnesota. And the very first proposal to come out of that was what we're calling the Lawn to Legumes Bill. And what that does is it provides $900,000 to homeowners or residents that want to convert some part of their yard or the entirety of their yard to some bee-friendly, some pollinator-friendly lawn alternative. So that can be a bee lawn like I studied, but that's really just one component of it. It can also support a rain garden. It can support what we call a native pocket planting, which is just like a small native garden bed in your yard. So it can go towards a lot of different pollinator-friendly planting.
I mean, that's incredible. Almost $1 million, I guess, a year now coming to this. And what's the response been like so far?
Yeah, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. So when this bill got passed, it was covered from everything from the Washington Post to our local CBS and Fox News subsidiaries. It was even on the front page of Reddit.com, which was exciting for me personally. and we just recently opened applications. I believe it was right in the start of January. And within the first week of opening our applications for this program, we received enough interest, enough applications, where we could have theoretically gone through all the funding just from those first batches of applicants alone. Because we want to have some geographic equity and allow more people to access the program, we are going to keep the funding open for longer than that. We also want to be able to show our politicians, our legislature, that there is very high demand for this, that Minnesotans really support this program. So for us, a successful program is getting as many applications as we can possibly bring in.
Hey, I want to get back to some of the, let's call it the mechanics of making this work, having a clover and grass-based setting. Again, up here, I'm gonna use, Park City's high desert environment as its example. Here we have to water, probably apply about an inch to an inch and a half a week to make Kentucky bluegrass green, keep it green and growing. Also add fertilizer, of course. And occasionally, at least in where I live, the property managers are applying some herbicides and maybe a pesticide or two. Again, is there are plants like clover and these other small blooming, short blooming flowers amenable to watering and fertilization and chemical applications that Kentucky bluegrass requires?
Yeah, so these lawn management practices or inputs that you discussed, irrigation, fertilizer application, mowing, et cetera, those will all...
Excuse the noise, we're in a construction zone here.
The duck white clover, the self-heal, the creeping thyme. The only one that would be an exception to that would be the application of herbicides, especially broad-spectrum herbicides.
Right.
So if you were to apply something like a glyphosate, then the flowers would not be able to survive through that. But all of those other applications or inputs that you mentioned, those would be just fine with the flowers that we utilize.
Okay. All right. That's good. So obviously, yeah, the Roundups of the world, not good for these
correct,
types of plants.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think especially at a residential level, we're starting to see homeowners use those products less and less.
Yeah, I agree. How about, and we've been talking about bees, but there are other pollinator species that probably benefit from these low-blooming flowers, butterflies or so, or maybe even a hummingbird or two?
Yeah, so I didn't see any hummingbirds, but I saw a lot of hemipterans, so those little, they're called true bugs with the sucking mouth parts. We saw a lot of those. I saw some butterflies and moths as well, and actually through the statewide program, we are making an active effort to use some monarch-friendly flowers, and if it's going to be used by the monarch, it'll be used by other butterflies and moths as well. So some examples of that are world milkweed and butterfly milkweed. So I'm sure many of the individuals in your community, especially those with a more ecological focus, know that association between milkweed and monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
But what they might not realize is that milkweed is also great for bees. And there's some really great research out of the University of Kentucky that shows those two species in particular, world and butterfly milkweed, both support the monarch caterpillars, and they support a great diversity of native bees.
So taking kind of a step even further back, why is it important to have pollinators in your yard? I think sometimes those of us that think about this a lot, you know, that's a natural leap. But why do we care that we have, you know, 50 species of bees using our Dutch white clover? Or why do we care that we want even, you know, a larger diversity of pollinators and bees around in our communities?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say there's a lot of benefits, and a lot of them are context-dependent. So if you're in a more rural, kind of ag-focused landscape, and you make this change to your yard area, then you're really supporting your kind of big agricultural growers near you. So any sort of vegetable and fruit farmers and growers. But since a lot of this is being applied in urban and suburban areas as well, I do like to focus on those benefits as well. So any sort of local garden, any sort of local food production is going to greatly benefit by an increase in pollinator diversity. If you just think about your local ecosystems, your local landscapes, the trees and shrubs and naturally occurring flowers, most of those are also insect pollinated, and the most common pollinators of those would be your bees. And also just supporting different trophic levels, so supporting different biological. When you support your bees, you're supporting first the lower, even lower trophic level, that vegetation, but also your birds, your small mammals, et cetera, all of those higher trophic levels that see insects and pollinators as a source of their food. So it's kind of, you know, you make one difference for one animal group, but it's repercussions up and down trophic levels.
Yeah, I always look at grass, traditional monolithic Kentucky bluegrass setting as flyover country. If you're a bee,
it's a pollinator desert.
Like, there's nothing here for me. You know, I'm going somewhere where there's more biodiversity. So it's just flyover country for them. I've got. I'm also curious about carbon uptake. You know, we're trying to be a net zero carbon community here. Is there any research that might suggest that a lawn that has lawn flowers or has more biodiversity to it has greater carbon uptake capacity than just a monolithic Kentucky bluegrass lawn?
So I can't speak to the exact comparisons of the species that were used in pollinator lawns versus a typical turf grass lawn, mm-hmm. but on the whole, in general, most other sources of vegetation do have a greater net positive impact in that regard. Mm. I mean, and for that state program where the types of plantings we're using are much more diverse than just the pollinator lawn, so also included in that is pollinator beneficial trees and shrubs. Anytime that you're incorporating a tree or a shrub, then you're definitely going to see a net positive impact with relative to Kentucky bluegrass.
Okay. That's encouraging. It's just another motivating factor for us to try to improve our biodiversity in our lawns.
It is, and I think it's so inspiring because it's something we can do so easily right at home.
Right.
Throw some wildflower seed out, or even less than that, just don't use herbicide so that these, you know, naturally occurring flowers can bloom in our yards. I love that.
And maybe have it, Nell and yeah. I are talking now. Maybe have a set aside, if, again, like where I live, we have acres of Kentucky bluegrass around. Maybe set aside a portion of that setting to just a no-mow zone and experiment with that and just plant wild flowers or seed it, and let's see how that unfolds over the course of it. Experiment a bit and then evaluate that over the year. So we're just riffing here about how we can apply this here and get people to grow less grass.
Well, James, I think that your research on this is, again, it's really inspiring. Are there other folks doing similar research out there right now?
Yeah, it's actually becoming more and more popular, which is very exciting in my opinion. So out at UMass Amherst, so over on the East Coast, there's two researchers there who've actually been doing this research and been publishing papers. The last names are Lerman and Malam. And they look at everything from what bees are using flowers in lawns to how does mowing frequency affect the number of flowers, the abundance and diversity of flowers that you see in a lawn area. You mentioned Watson, who I believe is out of Quebec, who just published that really high-impact paper, which was more of a meta-analysis of kind of just looking at what happens to insects and flowering plants when you just simply mow less. And Watson has done other great research. Jonathan Larson out of, I believe he started out at either the University of Kentucky or the University of Purdue, his master's work at the University of Kentucky. He asked a similar question to me, but he was more focused on those naturally occurring flowers. He is kind of one of those pioneers of white clover is a flower, it's not a weed. He also did the same for, what was the other species he did it for? Oh, dandelion, of course, yeah. So he looked at dandelion and Dutch white clover. So there's kind of a lot of these pioneers who keep popping up through the woodwork saying, let's just take another look at how we look at flowers and view them as something that's good for bees rather than a nuisance in our yard. One of the things that I always say at all my talks is, I still don't understand how people were convinced that boring, manicured green grass is prettier than a bed of flowers.
You know, we were just talking about this before the show, James.
Yeah.
How did that get started? Why is that our vision of perfection?
That's good marketing by Scott's Turf Builder.
Yeah.
So we are...
I didn't want to go that direction, but
I will.
If you can make a buck off of it,
well,
that's their point
right.
of view.
And now we've got to change behaviors. This is all about changing behaviors.
And I'm glad you mentioned dandelions because I had actually meant to ask about that. That's obviously one of our, you know, most frequent lawn flowers. And are we seeing a benefit of dandelions as well to our local pollinators?
Yeah, so dandelion is definitely a pollinator-friendly species. One thing that's really great about dandelion is it blooms really early in the season when there's fewer resources available. The only reason that I didn't include it in the seed mix that I used was one of the things you mentioned was changing behaviors. And for some reason with dandelion, when a resident or a homeowner sees that seed head, some just have it this irrational hate for it that I'll never understand. But we feared that if we included dandelion in the seed mix, it would decrease the likelihood that homeowners and residents would be willing to adopt this practice and implement these beelons. They'd see that dandelion was listed, they would envision that seed head, and they would toss the program aside and look the other way.
Right.
But
sure. If you don't mind that little seed head, then dandelion's great for bees, absolutely.
And right, I think we've talked about this in the past, that in the early part of the season here, spring, dandelion, or it was a beekeeper told me, dandelion is the primary source of pollen and nectar or so for bees up here in the spring. You know, and that goes through basically June. So it's an important source of food for bees. Now, the challenge with dandelions, though, is that their head is greater than 2.5 inches, right? So they're going to get mowed. We need to find a dandelion species that doesn't grow as high.
I think they'll grow below 2.5 inches.
You think so?
Yeah.
We can get them to do
I
that?
I do. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And lots of people mow. So we'd use 2.5 to be kind of on the conservative side, but it's more common for people to mow at, you know, to let their lawn grow out to 3, 3.5, 4 inches. And really, you know, the lazier the lawnmower, the lazier the land manager, the friendlier the more friendly you're being to your pollinators. So even if you cut down to 2.5, once you start letting it go grow out to 3.5, 4 inches, then there's plenty of room for those dandelions to get in.
I like it. The lazy lawn.
That's right.
There's our term. We need to grow a more lazy lawn.
Well,
it's kind of nice where, to an extent, the less you care about your lawn and the less money you throw at it and the less you try and keep that perfectly manicured kind of look, the more friendly you're being to your bees. So
right.
I don't mind the lazy lawnmower approach or the lazy land manager approach when it comes to a lawn.
Well, I'm ready to hop on board with this philosophy, James.
Only 4 months from now.
A mere 4 months from now. We have to kind of wrap up our time here, but I did want to ask, you know, what do you recommend as some resources for people who are thinking about doing some of this, maybe making some shifts on their own landscape?
Yeah, so this Lawn Leggings program is a state-run program led by our Board of Water and Soil Resources. And one of the things that they're doing that I am very excited about is, in addition to offering this funding, a great deal of that money has gone towards, so that $900,000 has gone towards the development of DIY, do-it-yourself resources for homeowners and land managers, creating publicly available webinars. So even though this is a Minnesota-funded program, all it costs for a bag of clover is $7, and that $7 will get you enough clover to share with you, all your neighbors, all your neighbors' friends. So if you're a self-motivated land manager, homeowner, resident that wants something beneficial for your bees, those DIY resources available on the Bowser page, just BWSR, will go a long way in helping you think about the different planting types that are the best option for you, depending on how much time you want to spend in your yard, how much financial flexibility you kind of have to go towards a lawn planting, and anything from a rain garden where you also want to do some water conservation work to a simple bee lawn. There's so many options that are available through this great DIY info.
And tell us again where we can find it. What's that website?
Yeah, so it's the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Uh-huh. So just if you type in MNBWSR on your Google search bar, that'll do the trick.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. That's James Wolfen with Metro Blooms.